just super grateful for all the support and everything else we received over the last year and couple of months. And yeah, we opened up last Wednesday to a bit of a bumpy affair. We did lose power, of course, right? We haven't been able to have guests in 18 months, but you know what? We're going to turn the power off.
It's the grand reopening that never was. I know, not to dwell on the past, right. But you're right.
Yeah. So we are open now Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday for lunch from 11:30 to 1:15. And our dinner hours on Wednesday have changed a little bit. We're now open at 5:30 and staying open until 7:45. So that's a half hour earlier than we were prior. But, you know, we just feel like we want to be more accessible to our clientele and to the community. So hopefully people really receive that well. And we have a couple of special things in store for our Wednesday evening guests that we're going to partner hopefully here with our music department and bring in a couple of musicians on Wednesday evenings and have some dinner music to go with our food.
That sounds just delightful. Not that we need a reason to go in and celebrate local, fresh, delicious food being created by students that are learning the craft, as you mentioned, in a gorgeous environment. You know, the 5101 is beautiful. And we can even have a glass of wine with it if we really want to, which is kind of rare, you know, on a college campus.
Yep. We have wine, we have beer, and we're working on, and I think we'll try to implement this probably late semester, but we are working on a couple of craft cocktails as well, just to kind of stay with the times. So we do offer those during our scholarship dinner. We'll always have two different cocktails at the scholarship dinner. This year it's on a Saturday, November 6th. And I did speak with Kevin Dewey and he will have a band here for that. We did that 2 years ago and it was a blast. It was a lot of fun. There was a great energy, not just in the dining room, but out in the student center with the live music and the bar out there and the lights were dimmed. It felt like a real party. It was great. It was almost kind of a last day party for some of us. But, you know, we're happy to be back. We've had a ton of great guests in here already. Last Wednesday for lunch, today for lunch, we were really busy. So it seems the word's getting out, but you know, like we always say, the more opportunity the students get to cook, the better they're going to be. And a lot of these kids want to master their craft. And so we always welcome all the help we can get in giving them the opportunity to cook.
Well, let's talk just for a little bit about the menu. I know that certainly, you know, in the previous run, the emphasis has been on a seasonal menu and being, you know, specific for what seasons we're in right now, when they're obviously, you know, in here in Michigan, we get all four of them. So we have lots of opportunity to explore a lot of different types of food on the menu. As we start off in fall, what can diners expect when they come to the restaurant? What does the menu look like currently? And I know it changes.
So currently, we're still living in a world of late summer. Mm-hmm. Last week, I got my hands on some amazing peaches from the Fruit Ridge up above, just north of Grand Rapids. And so we've got some peaches on the menu still. We still have corn. We still got some great tomatoes. I think one of the highlights that one of the big things that we changed this year, my heart is truly in pizza and it always has been and it always will be. But we added Neapolitan style pizzas to our menu and they seem to have really taken off. Our dough is really special because we don't use commercial yeast. But we do provide, you know, six of our like favorite ideas that go on pizzas. And then any of those toppings that we have that are already on pizzas, we, you know, tell our guests, hey, just make your own if you want. That's a big change, but yeah, we are still focused on bringing in local produce, bringing in the best meats we can bring in, the best fish we can bring in, and making sure that everything is in season, making sure that things are as local as possible, because we know, and we've learned this year more, I think, than any other year, is that when food is ripe and it's coming right off the vine and it's picked when it's at its peak ripeness, there's nothing better. We have to do less to the food than I would have to do if I were cooking tomato sauce with fresh tomatoes in December. And so, you know, our focus has been on working with our community, working with our farmers, so that when our students understand where the food is coming from and why we're doing so little to it to manipulate it to taste great, because Mother Nature's already done all the work, they come out with a greater appreciation for handling product, making sure things are fresh, making sure that things are local and farmed sustainably, which is hugely important these days. And, you know, just making sure that we are doing the right things because we are solely focused on food. We don't have an atmosphere where people can come and see and be seen. We don't have a craft cocktail program that, you know, we have these amazing cocktails. What we have are Detroit's next generation of great chefs that are working in our kitchens, and we focus on the food. And if people are truly interested in dining and eating great food, then the 5101 is the really, truly the place to go.
Speaking of that next generation of great chefs, and I know that is the emphasis and the focus of, you know, the culinary arts program at the college as well. There's been a lot of talk, certainly over the last 18 months, about, you know, how much or whether or not the restaurant, you know, world has been impacted and whether it's going to change the emphasis on dishes that are easier to take for carryout, stuff like that. Just from your perspective, what, you know, is the culinary world that students are going to go into when they graduate? And it always evolves, but is it that radically different than it's been all along that you can see?
No, but I think it will become.
Okay.
I think what we'll see is with a shortage of labor, I think what we'll start to see is more automation in the kitchen. I was talking to a mentor of mine, and he and I agreed that there's no reason why I should have to pay $15 for somebody to wash dishes per hour. We can find a way to automate that process. What I do think will happen is we'll start to see more pieces of equipment that are programmable enter into mainstream kitchens where all you got to do is press a button and the time, the temperature is already set and a timer goes off when the food is cooked and the cook takes it out. I think we'll see a lot more of that, especially in casual dining. And I think those guests who really crave that home cooked from scratch meals that they want to go out for, I think that will become what fine dining will be all about. And luckily for us, we'll always be on the forefront of that. We'll always be ahead of that trend because that's what we're focused on.
We are speaking this afternoon with chef de cuisine, Joseph Cosenza, from Henry Ford College's 5101 restaurant. Chef, what you just spoke about relates to sort of the variety in, I think, the well-rounded experience that students are getting when they come to take classes at Henry Ford College in the culinary arts and hospitality management component. So it is the culinary arts, but it's also learning how to work within and navigate within a hotel or a hospitality industry, restaurant slash hotel, but also kind of understanding, the business decisions that are going to be best so they can be positioned to not only perhaps work in an organization that's already existing, but also maybe some of the students want to open their own restaurant or, you know, work within a hotel environment or manage in the kitchen. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's always been a focus of ours, is making sure that our students graduate with a understanding that, you know, the business side of it is as crucial as the cooking side of it. You know, we talk in my class specifically about having two sides to this job as a chef. There's the subjective side, you know, oh, your food is really good. But there's the objective side where, you know, your labor percentage is a certain percentage of sales. Is it or is it not? Your food cost is a certain percentage of sales. Is it or is it not? And those are the things that keep businesses alive. It's not how good the food is. I mean, we all drive past restaurants and we're like, man, that place is terrible. I can't believe they're packed, right? We do that because it's so subjective. It's all based on opinion. And opinion doesn't sink a business as much as we'd like to think it does. Most of that comes from mismanaging labor, mismanaging food costs, mismanaging how you're running your business, or not even having enough capital to get started. So our focus not only is on cooking great food, but it's also being able to learn how to manage a business, have that foundation, whether you're getting an associate degree or a bachelor's degree, that contextual management learning is in that program no matter what. And you know, if a student just says, oh, I can cook great food and I'm going to go open up a food truck, that's only half of it. And it's not even the critical half. You know, the critical half is being able to manage that food truck and manage that business.
Makes good sense. And that's a part of the academic well-roundedness, really, with our program. Don't want to forget the baking and pastry side, which is maybe my favorite part of this sort of three tiers of exploration for what students are learning. But you also mentioned the bachelor, you know, the bachelor option, the bachelor's program option, which some might not know that well-kept secret either, that yes.
Well, you know, that's a secret too. But the thing about the way our industry is changing is this change happened probably 8 years ago. And that was organizations who run large, medium, small food service operations. They want educated chefs. They want educated managers. They want people who understand how to run a business, how to be able to read a balance sheet, how to read an income statement, and know that they have an idea of what it's saying and they can manage the business. They want educated chefs. It's as simple as that. You know, when I was coming up through the ranks, it was started in the dish pit and work your way up. And maybe you got into saute or maybe you got on the grill and that was great. But now there's more emphasis on making sure that our graduates are professional. They are educated and they are ready to be able to run a business when they're asked to do it. Now, that doesn't mean that we're saying you're going to graduate and you're going to be a chef. That's not the case at all. You're going to graduate and you're going to be a line cook. And you should spend as much time as you can on that line, learning from as many chefs as you possibly can and finding your own style, but also learning how to manage a business, because it doesn't just take education. It takes both education and experience in order for you to be able to be successful. And that key component, that experience component, I think gets lost when we start talking about recruiting and enrollment and things like that, because it's easy for me to say, hey, you're going to graduate from my program. You're going to go make $70,000 and be a chef. No. That's not going to happen, right? And if I was a business owner and I took a kid straight out of culinary school and said, hey, run my business, I deserve everything I get. You know, so these kids, they come into this and every day I have a student come up to me and say, chef, can you find me a job? Can you help me find a job? Can you help me find a job? This is so great. I can't wait to get in the industry. I can't wait to start working. And that's part that, you know, through our relationships in the community with some of the restaurants that we're friends with and some of the other organizations, that we can immediately place these kids while they're still in school. They can get that crucial experience they need while still studying. And it's huge for us because we've been able to spend a lot of time in the community building relationships, not just with high schools and bringing kids in, but with employers and getting kids out.
Makes great sense. In addition, the concept of giving the community an opportunity to come in and be a part of the learning experience for the students. We talked about how you said our guests are this, our guests are that. Please understand that when he's referring to the guests, he means the patrons, right? You're talking about the customers, if you will.
Well, yeah.
And customers, but also as, you know, you're kind of wearing many hats when you dine at the 5101, aren't you?
It's true. So I was always taught that anybody who walks in is a guest. One of the things that the way it was told to me was, okay, if your definition of hospitality is treating somebody like they're in your home, well, you don't call somebody who comes to your home a customer.
Yeah.
So if we refer to them as guests, we tend to have that little cognitive recognition that, oh, they're a guest. We got to treat them like a guest. And so we tend to treat people better when they're guests, as opposed to customers, because I've been a customer in places and I'll tell you what, I'm not a fan. But that being said, yes, you, when you do walk into the 50101, I think it's important to remember that you're in a classroom setting. I know it doesn't look like a classroom. It looks like a dining room because it is, but the students that are working as servers and managers inside the dining room, those are students that are in a class currently, and they're being assessed by their instructor. It's a lab class. And so we like to let our guests know that, one, yes, you are taking part in a student's education today by participating in their education by dining with us. But please remember that too. You know, remember that you're in a classroom. They are learning. There will be mistakes. Yes, they're going to forget your water, and maybe they're not going to replace the bread as quickly as they might in other restaurants, but that's part of the learning process. Aside from that, we are, you know, we do our best to make sure that no mistakes ever hit the table when it comes to food. We taste everything, make sure everything is to our standard before it goes to a table. That doesn't mean that my medium rare is the same as one of my guests' medium rare, but we're happy to always fix that whenever that that little subjectivity mismatch happens.
And it also means that that student experience, you know, sort of like that line in the sand is food safety and preparation and obviously making things that those mistakes don't become public facing, I'd imagine.
Those are mistakes we never make. We've been practicing food safety all our lives. We kind of chuckled when they started talking about some of these COVID protocols. We're like, we already do all this stuff on a daily basis as it is. You know, but we do want to remind our guests that when they do come to campus, that they do need to have a mask on when they come into the building. But once they sit down at the dining room table, they can remove their masks. That is a college policy. That is not our policy per se, but campus wide. So we ask that you please respect that. Also, parking is a little bit of a challenge right now. We are using the staff parking lot for all of our guests as well as all of our staff. But because there's so few staff here these days, our parking lot's fairly empty as it is. But, you know, it's an extra 20-30 yard walk, but I think that's good for people because people tend to come and overeat a little bit. And it's always good to get that walk in right after people eat food.
And it's great to have the dining room experience. Is curbside, is carry out available the way it has
Absolutely.
Been? Or do you have to come in and get it?
We prefer that you come in and get it because our online system, we're still not accepting credit cards. So you're still going to have to bring, you know, cash or a credit card into the building. But if you prefer, we'll have a student or someone come out to the car, bring your food, take the payment, bring it back. Whatever's most convenient, whatever is accommodating for our guests, I suppose. You know, I think that's the word we need to use right now is to make sure that we're most accommodating to everyone. So if that's I prefer curbside as opposed to walking in the building, great, we'll do it.
Thank you for that. When we talk about just the menu itself, I had to look it up because you said pizza. And of course, that's where my head's been pretty much since
I had some of those pizzas in the spring. Yeah. And I always thought Cosenza was like a nice Irish name, but now I'm making the connection to the pizza, right? Yeah. It's good stuff.
Thank you. The variety. Yeah. What we're seeing with the variety here, as well as other options, of course, with sandwiches, veggies, side dishes, make your own pizza concepts or create your own concept. But you've also got the standard soup and salad if people want something lighter mm-hmm. for lunch, and then different dinner entrees. But
Everything will change as the seasons change. What you'll see is the ingredients will change, but also our cooking techniques change, right? Nobody wants, my assumption is nobody wants braised beef on a hot July day, right? Maybe sometime in November, December, we'll start looking at braising some meats, making more of those comfort style foods, right? So it's important for the students to learn, not only does your ingredient change as the season changes, but your cooking techniques change as well. And that just comes from, like, we were talking about that in my class today, and they said, Chef, how come, you know, you have this, that, and the other thing on the menu? And I was like, because that's what I wanted to eat when I was writing the menu. And so more often than not, you start to write a menu as a chef and you start to realize, oh, this is just something I want to eat. And so it sounds delicious and I want to eat it. So I'm going to put it on the menu.
Well, that's just about the best lesson planning I've ever heard. That's tremendous.
That is.
I'm thinking, Alan, can we do that in our classes? It's not quite the same. It doesn't quite work the same. This is amazing. And it really is sort of that instant gratification, too, if you will. When we are talking about inviting people to campus again, I know we had a huge following prior to the whole COVID thing. And I know that following is going to come back and some probably were here for the carry out process, as you mentioned. But what about somebody that's never been before to the 5101 chef? Where will they find us? Where will they find you on our campus? We talk about building M, you know, the front of campus. And should we dress up? What are we expecting to pay?
You know,
credit cards as well as cash. You know, just give us the vibe.
I guess it's hard for me to explain where we are, but we're like right in the front of campus. I guess Evergreen is the front of campus, right?
It is.
So we're
yes,
right
correct.
In the front. Yeah. There's the infamous Circle Drive, right, where everybody goes in. And that's where we want people to come in. There is a small like stone sign that says Culinary Arts Center on it. It tends to be missable, but if you do call the restaurant's phone number, and I don't have that off the top of my head, Valencia or Lauren or whomever answers the phone, they're happy to get you back to where you need to go if you happen to miss it. Price-wise, we are a third less than just about every restaurant in the city. I believe the most expensive thing on our menu right now is an Eye of the Ribeye. And that I think is around like $13 or $14. That is a beautiful Michigan raised halal beef ribeye. And it's just the eye. It's not the eye and the cap. I believe that those two muscles need to be separated and cooked differently. We will feature the cap at some point. And if you ever do get the opportunity to have ribeye cap, it's one of the best things you'll ever eat. Dress wise, casual, at lunch, we've got anybody from the president Calvahuna in to the early college students. Like we had 30 of them in there today. It was a little crazy. But if you're looking for a night out and you want it to be special, absolutely dress up. In the evenings, we have the lights dimmed. Like I said, we're going to have some live music, hopefully. And we do have wine and beer. And so it'll be a really nice night out. We're happy to accommodate any special dietary restrictions. We're happy to, if you're celebrating something, we're more than happy to help celebrate it, whether it's, decorating a dessert to say happy birthday or happy anniversary, whatever we can do to make your experience even more fun than it would otherwise be.
Now, and I'm sure you have them memorized, Susan, you might have them in front of you. The hours for regular restaurant hours, which is goes on every week. And then also let's recap some of the special events that are coming up. You mentioned, I think, scholarship dinner, and I think there might be an Oktoberfest one or something like that.
Yeah, let me pop in with those. And also Chef Cosenza mentioned Lauren and Valencia, who are names that we identify with the 5101 as just wonderfully delightful women that are very involved in the execution of the day-to-day activities, as well as, certainly a staple of what makes the restaurant successful. So
I think there's an article about Lauren up on the HFC website at hfcc.edu. I was like, oh, I know that face. And I was, oh, well, no, there's a story behind it. I mean, there always is a story behind it. So that was nice to see. Yeah, anyway, continue.
Absolutely. So it looks like we have the fall hours for drop-in dining for lunch, 11:30 to 1:15. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So 11:30 to 1:15, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. And then the dinners on Wednesday evenings. And as Chef said, they're starting a little bit earlier. So starting at 5:30, going until 7:45 p.m. if you're looking on campus for the number of the building or the letter of the building, look for the big M. And when I ever tell people to come, even to the radio station, when I say, if you're coming to the M building, think of it as, there's the restaurant. That food is good. So that's how I always try to get you to remember which building, aside from 5101. But, and I'm just going to throw out the telephone number here. Then we'll have Chef Cosenza talk about Oktoberfest, which I think is the next big event, aside from being open for dining. And the number for more information, 313-206-5101. Easy enough, 313-206-5101. I will piggyback on that with the website, which has all this information. Simply go to hfcc.edu/5101. Easy enough. Chef, tell us about Oktoberfest. Always always something that people are looking forward to.
Always a good time. Oktoberfest, we will have sauerbraten, mashed potatoes, German potato salad, brats, sauerkraut, braised red cabbage, all that delicious comfort. How do I like to say it? Sour, acidic, beautiful German food.
Stick to your ribs food, basically.
That's right.
That's what my mom would cook.
I think we're doing fried chicken too this year. Kind of our style of Frankenmuth chicken.
Oh, love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. And that takes place on October 20th, just FYI. So what about making a reservation? Can we do so for dinner and special events? Should we consider that for lunch as well? Or how does it all work? What do you think?
Yes. How's that? You should. We would, you know, we always like to have an idea of how many guests we're going to have during the service. But if you can't, just show up. It'll be great. I do recommend making reservations for all of our special events, however, because those things tend to sell out pretty quickly. We have a lot of guests that like to bring in parties of 15, 20. So we get too many of those. And then we're having guests either have to wait extended periods of time or missing out. So definitely reservations for that. Aside from that, we'll have more information coming out about our scholarship dinner, which happens in just over a month. That'll be on Saturday, November 6th. That'll be something that guests will have to purchase tickets through the foundation's website. And once those go up, we'll make sure that everybody gets the word on that.
Sounds good. And I know the holiday buffet is always something to look forward to. And again, back to the pastries and things. I love the holiday bake sale. Just cannot get enough. And I know that's on schedule for late November as well. So we'll continue to share information, of course, to our WHFR listeners about all of these things, of course. But we just didn't want to wait any longer to make the formal invitation to not only have you as our guest, Chef Joe, but also to invite our listening community to be guests of the 5101 restaurant. So,
World College Radio Day was designed 11 years ago to harness the combined power of all student, university, and college stations around the world. This day of collaboration and unity allows us to amplify our voices and fundraise to help stations in need. If you're interested in participating in World College Radio Day or to become a supporter of World College Radio Day, please visit collegeradio.org.
And welcome back to the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek, glad to be with you this Friday afternoon here on the station Making Waves. As we continue our theme on today's program, talking about food, where it comes from, the changing of the seasons, eating seasonally, and of course the season that we are now just beginning, and that of course is the season of autumn and the season of fall. So in order to sort of tie all of those things together, I'm going to require you to take a little trip with us to northern Minnesota. And actually, I think it's going to tie things together quite nicely. We're going to bring to you a program called Harvest on Big Rice Lake, which was produced as part of a series called Fugitive Waves by the Kitchen Sisters. And each fall, the Ojibwe tribes of northern Minnesota harvest wild rice by hand. It's a long process that begins with families in canoes venturing into tall grasses where rice is pulled and gently brushed with knockers into the bed of the canoe.
We journey to the White Earth Reservation out onto Big Rice Lake in a canoe to see how one tribe is supporting itself and changing the diet of its people through community kitchen projects. Also, as part of the program, we'll talk with the founder of White Earth Land Recovery Project, Winona LaDuke, about the land, her fight to save wild rice, GMOs, her family, her philosophy, and her candidacy for vice president of the United States back in the 1990s and in the 2000 election as the vice presidential candidate on the Green Party ticket. We'll listen to it now here on the WHFR Journal. Let's work ourselves to northern Minnesota, where I imagine the trees and colors are already looking beautiful. Let's see what things are like there for the harvest on Big Rice Lake here on the WHFR Journal.
PRX.
The farther in the back, the better.
Yeah, going into the rice.
You get out there on the lake and it's misty. So it's just this beautiful, like, fog. One guy stands in the back and he has a pole. It's tall. Right in front of him sits this person who's going to knock. And they have these two long cedar sticks, known as knockers. Bawa Iganuk, that's what they're called, but everybody just calls them knockers and then they laugh, you know, Ojibwe humor.
Today on Fugitive Waves with the Kitchen Sisters, harvest on Big Rice Lake, and a conversation with Ojibwe leader Winona LaDuke, founder of White Earth Land Recovery Project and vice presidential nominee in 1996 and 2000 on the Green Party ticket with Ralph Nader.
Welcome to Fugitive Waves, lost recordings and shards of sound, along with new tales of remarkable people from around the world. We're the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva.
Some hidden kitchens are seasonal. They show up when they're ready. On the White Earth Ojibwe Reservation in northern Minnesota, the ricing season is short. It lasts maybe a month if the rain and cold weather hold off. We've been calling for weeks, trying to zero in on when would be a good time to record the harvest. No one would commit. The wild rice harvest begins when the rice is ripe. Today on Fugitive Waves, harvest on Big Rice Lake.
They call it the ricing moon. It's the name of the month, really, the ricing moon. It's like naming it September or something.
The wild rice making moon, Monominake Gizas. We got a lot of rice on this reservation. It's a tall grass. It grows up, you know, all over our lakes. We got 47 lakes. And who lives up here is Ojibwes and ducks. My name is Winona LaDuke. I live and work on the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota, and I direct the White Earth Land Recovery Project, which is working to protect our wild rice. This is like one of the biggest times in our community. As soon as it starts coming up, there's bantering about which lakes look good and where they're going to go ricing. These guys are excited about it, to get rice for their family, and they're going to get to sell that rice. These guys are making a couple grand, a lot of them. When he got maybe 60% unemployment, that's a lot of money.
I ain't going to say easy money because it's not easy money. It's fast money. I put a lot of school clothes on my kids because it's that part of the year. I am Ron Shelton, White Earth Land Recovery Project.
I hope this canoe holds.
You usually try to tie your canoe on the night before. The canoe being tied on is a sign of honor. Our community, if your canoe falls off the car on the way to ricing, it's really a shame. And you know if it falls off, someone will see you. You drive out there to your lake. You and your partner unload your canoe and you drag it down there. And, you know, it's already a workout.
Perfect.
Yeah. It's like heavy and, you know,
perfect.
We're a lot more sedentary these days.
There's your canoe.
Although, you know what, a lot of these guys are pretty buff looking.
The farther in the back, the better.
Yeah, going into the rice.
You get out there on the lake and it's misty. So it's just this beautiful, like, fog on the lake. It's quiet. There's nothing except for them birds. One guy stands in the back and he has a pole. It's tall. Right in front of him sits this person who's going to knock. And I have these two long cedar sticks known as knockers. Bawa Iganuk, that's what they're called, but everybody just calls them knockers and then they laugh, you know, Ojibwe humor. So you go out there and you pull your rice across your lap, and then you run the second knocker kind of diagonally across. And you hear the rice fall into your canoe, like that.
But you don't want to hit it too hard, then you knock the heads in. And if some fall in the lake, that's better. You're reseeding the lake.
You go back and forth and back and forth. You kind of try to keep some rhythm.
This is what you call crowfoot rice. See how it is?
Some looks like crow's feet. Some looks like a bottle brush. And it ripens at different times. They go and they start trying to domesticate varieties that would ripen at the same time. But they are not diverse. They're monocrop. And they put them in diked rice paddies. And a lot of times they're using fungicides and chemicals, and they go in and harvest it with a combine. That is different than two Indians in a canoe. They're trying to call it wild rice, but that's not wild rice. We call that tame rice. And it doesn't taste the same. Our rice tastes like a lake. It tastes like a lake.
My name's Ed Barnett, and when I was growing up, the whole community would get together to go out racing, and it'd be like a caravan, and everybody would just come right to the lake and help each other get in their boats out, and it was something to see, the young helping the old, and the old teaching the young how to do it through the whole process of gathering, harvesting, feasting.
Each season, we feast our foods. I serve the guys in the rice mill. There's like six guys working there. You know, in Minnesota, they call everything a darn hot dish. It's like wild rice, and I had some squash that I grew, and our buffalo meat. We now have this rice mill. All our equipment is kind of handmade. Well, it's a 49, 50, 51, 50, you know that old Johnny Cash song, I got a 47, 48, 49? You know, that's what that equipment's like. 60, 61, but you got something that's made by five or six handy guys, and it's running off of a tractor.
Well, I'm Pat Wicker, and I work for the White Earth Land Recovery Project. My job title is Sustainable Communities Coordinator Assistant, or something like that. Well, I'm the parcher. That's what we call it when we're cooking this, parching rice. Yeah. I cook on average 1,800 pounds a day. I can pretty much tell by the way the rice sounds in the barrel. When it's almost done, it makes like a sizzling, hissing almost. When it's getting close, I just go stand by the barrel and I listen to the rice.
We sell a lot to some food co-ops, and we sell a lot mail order. Hand-harvested, wood-parched, native wild rice. Maple syrup, buffalo meat, and jams made with honey. In a community that's got the poorest counties in the state of Minnesota, I didn't want to try to bring in some factory onto my reservation. They always are training and retraining our people. Training it for a job that doesn't exist, you know, and then he goes, tries to work in a border town. He cannot get hired. You make them feel like they're not going to be any good. And what we decide to do is say, what we got is something that we're good at. And what we are really good at is racing, instead of trying to make up some economy that makes no sense to us.
I do pretty much anything and everything, I guess, from maple syruping in the springtime to planting the fields. We build wind generators in the greenhouses and then solar panels.
Our wild rice is the centerpiece of our culture, but what we're talking about here is how you get healthy. You know, your body and your community, and they're all related. It is not something that you can go buy, you know, at the store, your culture. You have to live it.
Winona's cabin is on the reservation, 30 miles from the nearest town. It's wet, green, boggy, and beautiful, the headwaters of the Mississippi, with forests of pine and maple and not many people. A small patch of wild rice grows in the lake in front of Winona's place. It hasn't always been there. Some of the neighbors say it followed her when she came back.
Well, my neighbors are commenting on it. They said, how did that rice all get here? And, you know, it got here because of the ducks. I didn't do it. The ducks brought the rice.
Winona LaDuke is a force to be reckoned with. There's a poster on the wall of her study that shows her on horseback. It was part of her campaign for the vice presidency on the Green Party ticket with Ralph Nader during his first bid for the presidency.
I'm not someone who's necessarily inclined to run for office. You got to really feel compelled or really worried about the country to run for office, you know, and I'm kind of worried about it.
What was the best part about running for vice president?
It was just all these people. You know, it's an amazing thing, but people really want a democracy that works. They want to feel like they could vote for someone they believe in. They want to feel like they could believe in something. So you go to these rallies or you go someplace and people would just come crying that they finally felt like that there was something they believed in, or people would bring you their daughters. Oh, you don't know how many times I go out there and they still do it. People bring me their daughters and say, we want them to grow up and be like you. You know, and that's like the best thing.
What do you say to those girls when their mothers bring them to you?
After telling them, listen to their mom and study hard and eat their vegetables, like all those things, you know, because I have a lot of kids. Then I say, you know, think hard about things. Don't take everything for granted. You know, think critically and think with compassion too. You know, it's easy to be critical, but not have compassion for that person whose opinion you might disagree with. You have to think about why they think that.
Born in Los Angeles and raised in Oregon, Winona moved to White Earth, which is her father's reservation, after she graduated from Harvard in 1982. When she first arrived, she worked as the principal of the reservation's high school. 7 years later, she started the nonprofit White Earth Land Recovery Project, dedicated to restoring the local economy and food systems and preserving wild rice.
A long time ago, we started on the eastern seaboard. Those people out there are related to us, the Wampanoags and the Abenakis and the Lenni Lenape. We call them our old people because we came from them. We are instructed by some prophets to move west. And we were told if we did not move west, we would perish, which is pretty much true. Anybody who lived on the eastern seaboard is almost gone now. We followed a shell in the sky in our migration story. We traveled by canoe through those waterways to get to where we are here. We were told to go to the place where the food grows upon the water, and that was wild rice. In a lot of ways, it defines what it is to be Anishinaabe, or Ojibwe people, because we're the ones who have that rice, and everybody knows that. This is really the center of biological diversity for wild rice is right here. It doesn't exist anywhere else.
When Winona first moved to White Earth, the price of wild rice was being driven down by the influx of cheaper paddy rice from California. She and Margaret Smith, a tribal elder, set out to do something about it.
Margaret and I started getting mad about the fact that these guys were driving down the price of rice and trying to cheat those Indians instead of paying them $1 a pound, paying them 80 cents a pound. So Margaret and I, we go out there with our little bit of money, you know, $5,000, and we force those rice guys, those white guys, to up the price. We went there and we said, we're paying $1 a pound. And so all the ricers had come to us, and those guys didn't know how much money we had. It's kind of like playing cards, like bluffing, huh? You know, we could have had $500,000 for all they knew. Me and Margaret stuck in our bras, huh? You're up here in this time when we're harvesting. Ah, this is like one of the biggest times in our community. This moon here is called Manomenike Gizis, the wild rice making moon. We don't actually have four seasons. We have six seasons. We have the falling leaves moon and Ode Minigizis, which is a strawberry moon. We have our maple syruping moon, this sucker moon, which is when the suckers run. And when it's freezing up, gosh, Kodno Gizis. So us, we have this way of life that is based on the land. The idea of that Julius Caesar calendar is something that belongs to one culture, and I always have this problem with naming large things after small white men. Like, you know, who was that guy? Why do we have one whole system of time named after him?
For the next 4 years, Winona and Margaret drove up the prices, and Winona started White Earth Land Recovery Project, not only to improve the economics of the crops for the tribe, but also to protect the survival of wild rice. Their concern? That genetically modified rice is being grown in diked rice paddies in northern Minnesota. And when they drain the rice paddies, the modified rice seed goes into the public waterways and ends up in the lakes and native rice stands. Over time, the genetically modified rice can cross with native rice, creating what they call non-shattering varieties. So there's a guy with traditional parching equipment, and he can't get the hull off or can't get the rice to parch right.
And then they tell us that we should not be concerned. Well, you don't really got to worry about contamination. 500 feet. We'll keep our rice, you know, our rice beds, our test beds for our new purple Petrovsky or Macintosh. And I don't mean to repeat this, but I have a problem with the naming thing. Big mountains after small men. This whole continent is badly named. So anyway, they grow this out, and they say, oh, Ojibwe's don't have to worry about it. And the studies find, oh, you know, there's a little wind drift with the seed. Oh, yeah, but you guys don't really have to worry. It's really a minimal risk. So then we ask, what about the ducks, buddy? Zishibik, that's our word for ducks in Ojibwe. And in our stories about where we got rice, we were taught about rice by the ducks. That's why I got rice in front of my house. The duck cannot delineate between a paddy rice and a lake rice. And they drop that rice in there. And these guys got all these scientific models. What about the ducks?
How was your childhood? How were you raised? And how did you learn all of these paths?
It's kind of a strange, it's not a strange story, it's my story. My mother comes from New York. Her parents were Jewish immigrants from the Ukraine. The story is that my great-grandfather was a miller, so he milled wheat. In the Ukraine, he had a windmill, and he was put out of business by someone who had a coal-powered mill. 80 years later, I'm putting up wind turbines. And so my mother met my father, and he was a white Ojibwe. And he comes from a really traditional family up on the northern part of the reservation. And in his family, he was the one who spent all his time in the woods. And he decided that he was going to go sell wild rice in New York. And that's how he met my mother, is selling wild rice in New York.
But where was he selling?
Exactly. Let's zone in on that moment.
Okay. Well, I don't know. Like, he drove out his one Indian car to New York. And so he meets my mother, who's like this really stunning, she's an artist. Her name is Betty LaDuc. Living like in a loft, big paintings. She was hanging out with all the hip, radical, artist, socialist people. I mean, like, my mother is like a contemporary of Diego Rivera. And so they eloped. The story is my grandparents didn't understand what he was. You know, the quote is, oh, he's not a goy. He's not a Jew. What is he? They had no conceptual framework for an Anishinaabe. No, so that's why they had to run off. They ride off in the Rambler. They go to L.A., where the Westerns are starting to film. And so there's all these Indians that are in the Westerns. And my dad must have got wind of that. My dad was a real handsome guy. And he could ride a horse, and he looked like a real Indian and all. I remember we used to hunt in Santa Barbara and by Pasadena. And, you know, there was all these places that my dad used to go hunting. And so when I was little, we ate all this wild food, plus that wild rice. When I was real little, we used to come back to the reservation to White Earth, and I always knew that I had family back here, because my dad was the only one that ever really left. And so that's where I lived, you know, when I was born. And then my parents separated, and I was raised in a small town in southern Oregon. First time I came back was 79, to White Earth.
And what was that like when you came back?
I came for political conference. You know, I went to Harvard as an undergraduate, and I got politically active. It was 4 years after Wounded Knee. The American Indian Movement had become really active. And so I was raised largely politically by the American Indian Movement. And my father had run a lot of food to Wounded Knee and, you know, would stop by and tell me. A lot of the men from the American Indian Movement, men and women, are from the White Earth Reservation. So I would work with those guys. I was a researcher. You know, that's what I did. I still do that. They'd always say, oh, when are you going to move home? When are you going to come home? It took me about 2 years, and then I moved home. And I lived here ever since. So here I am. I find that I'm working on the same things my father and my great-grandfather worked on. Because that's how it takes sometimes. It takes generations to fix those things.
So your dad in Hollywood doing the movie thing, what did that do to him spiritually, having been in the woods forever and loving that? What was that like for him?
It transformed him in a lot of ways, and he kept some things. You know, his name was Vincent LeDuc. L.A. in the 60s, you know, was like bizarre. Indians in L.A. in the 60s was like really strange. You know, I think a lot of those people were looking for something, and my dad, he had a gift. It was a spiritual gift. He became known as a man named Sun Bear, and he was like this new age spiritual leader. He has like 4 books that he wrote. You know, and he had an 8th grade education, but he had this huge following of a lot of new age people that came out of California or all across the country. He just believed that people should get back in touch with the earth, you know, and he had a set of teachings, and his teachings were, you know, Ojibwe based, but how that is translated. But he had one saying that I use. As he said, I don't want to hear your philosophy if it doesn't grow corn. That's what he said. You know, because there's a lot of people who just spend their entire lives in their mind telling you how to run your life. That's what he said. I don't want to hear philosophy if it doesn't grow corn. Grow food.
Harvest on Big Rice Lake was produced by the Kitchen Sisters, mixed by Jim McKee. Thanks to Hidden Kitchen's co-executive producer, Jay Allison. The White Earth Land Recovery Project has a store. It's called Native Harvest, and they sell wild rice, organic coffee, strawberry and raspberry teas, and beautiful birch bark baskets. There's a link to the store at kitchensisters.org/fugitivewaves. And you'll also find photos and recipes for wild rice hot dish and wild rice stuffing. Fugitive Waves is produced by the Kitchen Sisters with Nathan Dalton and Brandy Howe. Thanks to our production interns, Marina Brazier-Furbush, Christopher Mosen, David Fox, and Zoe Kurland. And thanks to Nathan Dalton for his music, The Skin Horse, and Vyacheslav Pogorzelski for his Hidden Kitchen's theme variation. We want to give special thanks to the National Endowment for the Arts. Art works. Fugitive Waves is part of Radiotopia from PRX, a collective of the best story-driven, creative, cutting-edge radio shows on Earth. Radiotopia is made possible with support from the Knight Foundation and MailChimp, who celebrate creativity, chaos, and teamwork. If you'd like to become a sponsor of Fugitive Waves or other shows like it, email sponsor@prx.org. There are 14 shows in our Radiotopia collective. You'll find them all at radiotopia.fm. Take a listen. And don't forget to subscribe to Fugitive Waves. Stories from the flip side of history.
Radiotopia. From PRX.
A trip to experience the harvest on Big Rice Lake here on today's WHFR Journal. The program produced in 2016, so about 5 years ago, and brought to you today here on our program as we look at rice harvesting in northern Minnesota by the Ojibwe tribes on the White Earth Reservation. We do hope you enjoyed it. Quite an interesting auditory experience and perhaps a nice little trip on a Friday afternoon to a place that I'm certain is very beautiful this time of year and normally is. I'm Alan Mazurek. Thanks for being here for the WHFR Journal. I'll be here until 2 o'clock. Susan McGraw and I are always glad to spend time with you on these Friday afternoons, and we do hope you'll stick around for the next few minutes and for a trip down Highway 61, which, come to think of it, also begins in Minnesota in the Twin Cities, really not that far away from Big Rice Lake on the Ojibwe Reservation there in, that's in northern Minnesota. I guess the Twin Cities would be considered central Minnesota. Anyway, we'll be going back to Minnesota one way or the other in just a few minutes as Kitty Love takes us on a trip down Highway 61. To wrap up our program, however, we're going to take you sort of into the classroom here at Henry Ford College and bring you an episode of the WHFR Journalism, or the Henry Ford College Journalism class, Neighborhood News, here on WHFR. Now, this is a class class that I have the pleasure of teaching in the fall and in the winter semesters. And during the course of the semesters, our students learn about the craft of broadcast news writing and reporting. And obviously, we have to start somewhere. And in the radio business, we usually do that by putting on a show, by hosting a newscast. Now, of course, in years past, we've been able to have all of the students crammed into our little studios here at WHFR. Not necessarily doing that this semester, but we still wanted to have the opportunity for you to hear their work and for their work to be broadcast to an audience as well. So the class started just a couple of weeks ago, and we're going to let our students take their first crack at bringing you their news stories on the WHFR Neighborhood News here on the WHFR Journal.
On Wednesday, the grand opening of Mom's Spaghetti gave fans the ability to visit M&M's restaurant. The concept was inspired by the Detroit native song, Lose Yourself. According to the Detroit News, just above the restaurant will be a gift shop. Both are located at 2131 Woodward in Midtown Detroit. The concept for the restaurant started at the peak of the pandemic when the rapper provided food to frontline workers. Now everyone has a chance to taste the infamous Mom's Spaghetti. I'm Kayla Clark, reporting from the Henry Ford Journalism class.
I am Tara Brown. The Detroit News reports a 22-year-old Harrison Township man was sentenced Tuesday to a year of probation after pleading guilty in June to misdemeanor theft of government property less than $1,000. In March of 2020, Anthony Cassani was part of a cleaning crew hired to sanitize office space used by the FBI. Cassani used his cell phone to photograph a chart in an FBI agent's cubicle. The chart included photos, facial images, and names of individuals investigated for gang activity. Cassani then posted the chart on various social media platforms where it was shared and seen by the public and multiple street gangs. According to a sentencing memo, Cassani indicated his intent was not to hinder the FBI investigation by taking the photo and, quote, cooperated immediately without counsel. The FBI investigation was not compromised and no agents were injured, but acting U.S. Attorney Saima S. Mohsin said in a memo, this crime is a window into Cassani's lack of respect for the law and the need to provide just punishment for this offense. The memo also revealed Mohsin wanted Cassani to serve 3 months in prison in addition to a year of probation. The incident is Cassani's fourth criminal conviction in the last 4 years, with two of those previous convictions involving theft.
Get down on it. Detroit shake this groove thing back to the 70s and 80s. According to the Detroit Free Press, last weekend, the city's most famous television dance show, The Scene, came back for two nights in Midtown Detroit. Of course, everyone was invited. The Detroit Free Press remembers The Scene as a cultural phenomenon in Detroit on WGPR-TV, which is Channel 62. Much like the popular network program Soul Train, the show allowed dancers to showcase their moves. It also featured national and local musical talent. The show was hosted by Nat Morris, who also was the show's executive producer. The Scene and D'Electricity, along with Nat Morris and friends, took over the Nighttime Festival of Art and Light in the Detroit Cultural Center, Beacon Park, and Circle Park. For WHFR, I'm Dejana.
This is Andrew Rucker. Former U of M and NBA star Chris Webber is opening a new cannabis facility in Detroit. The Webber Wellness Compound is a $50 million, 9-acre facility that will include a free educational program about the cannabis business. It will be offered to minors and underrepresented students, as well as job opportunities for the next 3 years. MLive says that the Hall of Famer partnered with Lavetta Willis, who co-founded Players Only Holdings, the cannabis products distribute in this development. The business will begin construction this fall and to be completed in March of 2022. It will be located at 2599 2nd Street in Corktown, Detroit.
Our WHFR Neighborhood News, courtesy of broadcast journalism students from the class TCM 261 here at Henry Ford College, which I have the pleasure of teaching. My name's Alan Mazurek. That's going to wrap up today's edition of the WHFR Journal. We're making waves here at 89.3 FM, online at WHFR.FM. This is WHFR Dearborn. We'll be right back.
Highway 61 is on the air. I am DJ Kitty Love, and I will be here with you until 4 o'clock. That's